From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Gun violence in America has gotten so bad that war surgeons are learning from doctors who work in American cities. On today's Fresh Air, we meet a doctor and nurse who treat gun injuries and founded a center to help prevent them. They've trained doctors preparing to go to war zones. Also, Amy Sedaris talks about the film adaptation of her Comedy Central series, Strangers with Candy, and talks about her brother, David Sedaris. And critic John Powers reviews the latest World War II spy novel by Alan First. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dr. William Schwab, is a trauma surgeon who sees the consequences of urban violence. He treats several hundred gunshot victims a year. Surgeons from around the world now come to him to learn how to treat gun wounds. Dr. Schwab is the chief of traumatology and surgical critical care at the University of Pennsylvania Health System in Philadelphia. He considers gun injuries an epidemic that is preventable. So along with Dr. Therese Richmond, who will join us a little later, Schwab founded the Firearm Injury Center at Penn, whose mission is to create safer communities through the systematic reduction of firearm injuries. What were the kinds of injuries that you were seeing that led you to create the Firearm Injury Center?
What we were seeing is an ever-increasing number of complex multiple gunshot wounds in the youth of Philadelphia. And we decided together as a team that we needed to look at the root causes of this. Rather than just patching these young, generally men up and turning them back into their environment, we really decided that what we needed to do is find why this was happening, see if we could analyze that, and intervene beyond just physical surgery or physical medicine, and put people back into the community.
Have the gun injuries that you're treating changed in the years that you've been treating gun injuries as guns and bullets have changed?
Yes. They changed drastically, actually, in the late 1980s. You may not remember, but in the mid-1980s, the 9mm semi-automatic pistol was made commercially available to citizens of the United States. They could buy that gun. That gun is a pistol. It's different than a revolver. It can fire multiple bullets in a very, very short time span. It led to multiple bullets striking the human body. Prior to that, gunshots weren't rare in the United States, but in fact, most of the time, someone was shot once. And starting in about 1988 and through now, what we've seen is an ever-increasing number of bullet holes, organs injured, and when one looks scientifically, there is very, very good data and experience to say the more number of times you're shot, the more number of organs injured, the higher your death rate. So more complex wounding, more complex sequelae, and a higher death rate because of the weaponry.
And how does that affect how you treat a patient? You know, if they have one gun wound, you could focus on that wound, but if they have several bullet holes, how does that affect the treatment?
Well, it drastically changes how you treat those injuries. And what's interesting is that the more times the human body is shot, the more tissue destruction, the more bleeding, the more shock, and the more physiologic consequence of all that. Something that's known as now is the lethal triad of death, which is a cold patient who's in shock, who's acidotic, and can't coagulate or stop their bleeding. So starting about 12 to 14 years ago, we had to look at a different way of doing surgery. We had to do it in an unconventional way. And we developed techniques that look at minimal acceptable care of each of those injuries. Minimal acceptable care to stop bleeding, to prevent that lethal triad from spiraling down and leading to a quick death. The term we put on that is damage control. When one reads about what's going on in Iraq or Afghanistan now, or one reads about things that are happening in the military around the world, one reads about damage control. Damage control is unconventional surgery where someone is dying from wounds. And all the surgery that is done when they are first encountered is stopping bleeding and saving life. And then resuscitating a patient and bringing them back a day or more later and fixing everything anatomically.
What would go wrong if you did it the other way around? If you tried to fix everything the first time around instead of doing damage control and then really fixing it a day later?
What happens is that the experience shows that people aren't able to tolerate long surgery. The hypothermia, the acidosis.
What's acidosis?
Acidosis. You and I live at a certain balance in our body between alkaline and acid. pH is what it's called scientifically. Our body requires a very normal range physiologically for all the cells to function. If it becomes too acid, there's too much acid around, then things don't work very well. The cells don't work. Cells don't make energy cells don't utilize oxygen and glucose sugar so that you maintain energy support systems. And like a computer, it very quickly shuts down. Damage control is aimed at interrupting that spiral. And if we now have good evidence to say that if you stay and try to fix everything and prolong surgery, that in fact the death rate is higher.
I've interviewed people about injuries in Iraq. And what I'm hearing there about the improvised explosive device wounds sound kind of similar to what you're talking about, because those IEDs, you got multiple shrapnel wounds. So it's not just like one bullet to treat. So what were some of the connections between the kind of medicine you're doing in the city of Philadelphia and the kind of medicine being practiced in Iraq now?
Well, there's a lot of similarities. First and foremost, the type of wounds, whether it's multiple bullets from a pistol or one high muzzle velocity bullet wound from a military weapon or an IED, when the tissue destruction is extensive enough, the same problem with maintaining normal physiology occurs. So whether the person is an IED attack or explosion, a wound, what's going on in Iraq is pretty much exactly the same techniques that are being used as were being used in Philadelphia and the major cities in the United States in the last 10 or 12 years. Damage control is very prominent in the way individual surgeons are handling wounds in Iraq, as well as the mentality on the battlefield, which is that far forward surgeons will do a damage control procedure, stop bleeding, stop contamination in and around the body, and then what they will do is pack those open wounds and ship that patient back where they'll have definitive surgery hours or days later, exactly as the damage control that we described from Penn in 1992.
So does this mean that war medicine is learning from shootings in American cities and what the doctors are doing there? Has violence in American cities gotten to the point where the war doctors are learning from the urban doctors in America?
The answer is yes. And as a matter of fact, that may be a paradigm shift that's occurred in the last 15 years. War in the history of man has been the greatest stimulant to the advancements in medicine and surgery. And what happened in the late 1980s in many of our large urban areas in America, we saw an ever-increasing of these complex wounds from handguns. Surgeons had to adapt. Surgeons had to develop. Surgeons had to be imaginative and come up with new techniques that we found worked and saved people's lives. If you track back during that time and up to the present time, we've been training our surgical trainees, our fellows, on all these techniques. And they are, in fact, the military surgeons, the combat surgeons that are in Iraq using these techniques. The improvement in survival was so profound in the early 1990s, dealing with these gunshot wound victims, this terrible liability, that in fact the United States Armed Forces changed the war manual, that manual that directs most care on the battlefield, and added damage control as a principal technique to take care of these wounds. So I think the answer to the question is yes. These combat surgeons have learned from us, and now they're having wonderful successes with our combat soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Dr. Schwab, we've mentioned that you've trained doctors who have subsequently gone to Iraq and practiced combat medicine there. But I also know that doctors from countries around the world have come to your center to learn about how to treat gun wounds. Why do they need to come to your center, and why do they need to know more about guns? Is it because of increasing violence in their countries?
Well, when one looks at the need for surgeons in an emergency situation, and one looks at it globally, there's a number of areas where a surgeon's needed. Certainly combat surgeons, but also, interestingly, in response to the need for organizations like NATO, the United Nations, the International Red Cross, all those civilian relief medical organizations want physicians that know how to take care of wounds. Why? Because those organizations move in response to conflict. So about 15 years ago, a number of surgical leaders around the world got together and said, this is interesting. We have several countries in which the doctors and nurses are being mobilized to support those efforts, and they have no experience with treating wounds. And it was suggested that, in fact, that they come to the United States. So for about 10 years, we've had surgeons coming, and they spend time with us. For me, personally, it's been a way to take a terrible liability in American society and at least make it, to some degree, an asset. But what we've seen is a constant flow of physicians from the Asian Rim, from Australia, from New Zealand, and especially from the Scandinavian countries, who come with us for about a month. And in a month's time, they probably see more gunshot wounds and major injuries than they will see in three or four lifetimes in their current countries.
My guest is Dr. William Schwab, Chief of Traumatology and Surgical Critical Care at the University of Pennsylvania Health System and co-founder of the Firearm Injury Center at Penn. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. William Schwab, Chief of Traumatology and Surgical Critical Care at the University of Pennsylvania Health System and co-founder of the Firearm Injury Center at Penn, which is trying to cut down on gun violence by treating it as a preventable epidemic. In a couple of minutes, we'll be joined by the center's co-founder, Dr. Therese Richmond, a nurse who has cared for many gun victims and is an associate professor of trauma and critical care nursing at Penn. Now, I think you served in the military in Vietnam. Do I have that right?
I was trained in the United States Navy during Vietnam, but I never went to Vietnam, the country.
Did you ever practice combat medicine?
I did. I trained in a large naval hospital on the East Coast. At that time, it was 1,900 beds, and I was one of the surgical house officers and eventually the surgical faculty that were receiving wounded soldiers back from Vietnam. In those days, as opposed to now, it would take 3 to 4 weeks to receive them back. Now it takes, as you well know, 4 to 5 days, sometimes less, to be back from Iraq. But we had a very, very large part of our practice was related to taking care of the delayed complications of wounding and to manage some of the more definitive surgeries and reconstruction of these young soldiers and sailors. And that's where I became interested in trauma surgery and in ballistics and in wounding.
Yeah, so what are some of the things you learned from combat medicine that you've applied to working in an American city?
There's a simple answer to that, and there's a complex answer. The simple answer is one of the first things that one had to learn in order to be a military surgeon is you had to learn ballistics. Ballistics isn't a part of the typical conventional medical education. But interestingly, my background in ballistics, because of my military background, really afforded me, if you would, the science of wounding and how it applies to medical care. So I felt very, very comfortable with that. The second thing that you had to learn to be a military physician, and it was taught to you as part of the standard curriculum of military surgery, was how to triage, how to make very, very important decisions about life and death and be comfortable with those with a minimal amount of data. And the scenarios that we were put in where you're the surgeon, you have a certain amount of resources, you have a certain number of operating rooms, you have a certain number of units of blood, and you're receiving 30 wounded soldiers. How do you sort those out between those that are dead, those that will die, no matter what you do, and those that you can help, and those that you don't need to do very much about? I think that set us up very well and set me very well to lead a civilian trauma surgeon, where many nights at the University of Pennsylvania, other places in this city, we're seeing literally 10, 12, 15 patients all coming in with a matter of minutes that need care. And it allows you to teach that. Again, not a conventional part of medicine as it is taught in our medical schools and in our training hospitals, but the military provided that for me.
What kind of flipped the switch for you to go just from practicing medicine to trying to practice prevention of violence, to set up a program about preventing the kind of violence that you end up treating?
The personal side of this is there is nothing more painful in my life than walking out of an operating room and telling a young mother or a father that his 16 or 17-year-old child is dead because of a gun wound. That experience, week after week, night after night, in the early 1990s, was so emotional, and is to this day so emotional for me, that I had to turn to people that had skills and experience that I don't have and say, how can we stop this? I can patch him up. Surgeons can stop the bleeding. But this is a disease, this is a problem that goes well away from the operating room. And it just seemed like we were being overrun constantly with these young kids, these beautiful kids, and we needed to do something to find a way to break the cycle. And so we started, with Terry Richmond's help, we started the center, and the rest is history.
What are you trying to do that's different than what was done before to try to prevent violence?
Well, I think the most important thing is what we're trying to do, and what we tried to do in the early 1990s is to say to American medicine, to the American public, this is a public health problem. This is something that needs to be conquered. I mean, it's not exactly the same as cancer. It's not the same as an infectious disease. But this is violence. And violence should be able to be studied, and we should be able to find a way to lower the toll from violence or to identify early on those people that may enter into a violent situation or commit an act of violence.
So what's your approach? Are you looking for legislation? Are you talking to the gun lobby, working for gun control? Like, what's the focus?
The most important focus that I think could be identified right away is research. And only through legitimate research will we be able to identify the root causes of why people become violent. And at the same time, we have to have some short-term solutions to try to lower the toll and to try to live safer in a society that has chosen to live with guns. And I think you ought to ask her that.
Terry Richmond, what do you think?
That's my mantra, isn't it?
It is. That's why I used it.
Yes, I agree that obviously research is key. But, you know, I think the first thing and how we approach it differently, you actually in your question said, you know, do you talk to the gun lobby? You talk about gun control? No. Our goal as injury scientists is to decrease injury and death from gun violence. And by focusing on decreasing injury and death, we totally stay away from what's been very polarized in this country, pro-gun or anti-gun. So from a practical perspective, the first thing we want to do is to get people to talk to each other. So I could say, you could maybe very pro-gun, but I could say, well, can't you agree with me that we want to decrease injury and death? Can we agree on that? Then let's think about how we can do that. People think, you can't stop this. I shoot you, it happens in the blink of an eye. It's not like I've had years and years and years of risk factors to develop cancer or heart disease, in a way. But in another way, you may have had years and years and years of risk factors that put you at risk for being shot. And it's simply, if you think about at-risk people in at-risk environments with hazardous objects, those three things come together in a point in time and an injury happens. If we go back and think about all those things that have to come together, I just have to interrupt one path in order to prevent that gun injury. that opens up a whole nother world of opportunities. It takes it away from pro-gun, anti-gun.
One last question. You've taken out a lot of bullets from a lot of wounds. What do you do with the bullets afterwards? Do people usually want them?
Actually, there's a chain of evidence that's required when one removes a bullet. And it's not like television or the old Westerns that we watched when we were kids when it was dropped into the metal bucket. In fact, what happens is that there's a very specific technique to remove a bullet or a bullet fragment. It is witnessed as it is passed from the surgeon to the circulating team in the operating room. It is labeled. There is a evidence chain. It is passed through hospital security and either to the Philadelphia or police or the FBI. It's a very, very strict procedure. Subsequently, when people come back and ask us to remove bullets, we remove bullets if they're having problems with the bullets. Bullets rarely migrate. They don't travel in the human body. They usually get encapsulated in a thick scar that prevents them from moving. And interestingly, there's probably over 300,000 Vietnam veterans that still have their shrapnel bullets left from Vietnam. So we know that they don't move around. But we remove bullets if people ask us to do it. For example, if it's under your belt line or if it's on your shoulder or if it's underneath where you put your pen every day and it's causing you a problem, most physicians and surgeons are glad to remove that. But most bullets are really left in the human body. They cause no problems. Again, it goes back to the old saying of firstly, do no harm.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. William Schwab and Therese Richmond co-founded the Firearm Injury Center at Penn. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Delacorte Press, publisher of Stuart, A Life Backwards, the biography of the unlikely friendship between a homeless man and the author, Alexander Masters. And from Warner Home Video, presenting the film Syriana, Where Oil Collides with Terrorism, on DVD now, and starring George Clooney, Matt Damon, and Jeffrey Wright. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a 47-year-old ex-con junkie whore with the hairstyle of a pro golfer. We talk with Amy Sedaris about her character in the movie adaptation of her Comedy Central series Strangers with Candy. And John Powers recommends a new spy novel by Alan First. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie Strangers with Candy is a prequel to the Comedy Central series of the same name, which was created by its three stars, Stephen Colbert, Paul Dinello, and my guest, Amy Sedaris. Sedaris is a performer who has collaborated with her brother, the writer David Sedaris. Strangers with Candy is inspired by after-school specials, but the characters learn all the wrong lessons. Amy Sedaris plays Jerry Blank, a 47-year-old ex-con, junkie, and prostitute who dropped out at 15 but has decided to return to high school and pick up where she left off. In this scene, she walks into her first class. Her teacher is played by Stephen Colbert.
We have a new student. Jerry Blank. Okay, Mr. Blank, why don't you tell us something about yourself?
Oh, All right. Well, hello. Well, I'm Jerry Blank, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm also addicted to amphetamines as well as mainline narcotics. Some people say I have a sex addiction, but I think all those years of prostitution was just a means to feed my ravenous hunger for heroin. It's kind of like the chicken or the nugget. The point is, I'm addicted to gambling. Thank you.
I asked Amy Sedaris what she did physically to play the character Jerry Blank.
Well, I have a fatty suit on. I had one made years ago to fool my father that I had gained weight. David wrote about it. I'm sure everybody knows about that. But I wanted, you know, I'm not someone who likes to play sexy or pretty or anything like that. But with a fatty suit on, I can do it. And so I wanted to play. It just made me make her like really physical and sexual. And so I like that. And she's a loser. And she's And there's something about playing losers that I like, too. You know, you have to try harder, you know, and they're always trying to be liked. And I like playing people like that. But at the same time, Jerry likes herself. I like myself. And all my characters like themselves. And I like people who are unattractive, who like to dress up to be attractive, but aren't really that attractive. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, well, tell me why you like that.
Because they have so much working against them. I like having stuff to work against, you know? Like, in real life, you know, it's the opportunities are different for unattractive people than they are for pretty people. And I just, everything's just harder. And I like playing people that have a hard time.
Well, you know, and also in situations like that, things that are supposed to be pleasing and seductive become really menacing. Like there's a scene in which you're kind of doing this seductive dance for somebody who you're trying to seduce, and it's so wrong in every way.
The desperation,
Jerry, exactly.
Just wants to be liked. And I like the hairstyle. I wanted to have a professional golfer's hairstyle. And I like short haircuts on women. And I liked, for wardrobe, I just told Vicki Farrell, who did the wardrobe, that I owned a snake. And that's all I ever told her. So everyone, you know, really brought Jerry Blank alive. And the facial expression, you know, I mug, you know, and I like making faces. And she's that character is all in all the plays that David and I write together. She's like always the actress, and then I just give her a different background for each play. It's like those actresses that think they're versatile, but they're not. You know, it's always the same person, and you're like, but wait a minute, you know, you want me to believe that you're, you know, a policewoman, you know, they're just never convincing. Mm-hmm. And so I always think of the character like Jerry Blank, it's the same thing. It's always that actress that I play, and then I just give her different backgrounds. And this time she got to be Jerry Blank. So she's the true actress. I'm more like, I'm just a clown. I'm not an actress.
So wait a minute. So this is like a double image here. You see yourself as impersonating this actress who actually gets roles in movies.
Are you high? Yeah, exactly. I know. Even when I have to audition for something, I can't read it unless I do that voice, because then I know where to make pauses. I'm a horrible reader, you know. I'm just not good at it. Or if I have to read something, understand it. If I read it in that Jerry Blank type voice, and I'm like, oh, okay, I know where to put the pause, or I know how to read it, or I know how to understand it now. It's kind of weird, but it's just easier for me to do things through her.
Now, you're actually very attractive, and I think
you only say that because I play someone
that.
Ugly.
Yeah.
I really believe that people will say, "Gosh, Amy, you're so pretty," but I'm like, you wouldn't say that if, you know. I just tend to play people who are a little unattractive, so I mean, I don't usually think that people would really say that to me if they didn't see that I played unattractive people. Don't you know what I mean?
Right. You mean if we weren't measuring.
If I played someone pretty, if I was a pretty cop on TV all the time, or was in Sex and the City, or all that kind of stuff. I doubt you'd say, "Amy, you're so pretty," because then you'd say, "Oh, she knows she's pretty because she always plays those pretty parts." You know.
So are you? Do you
think I'm pretty?
Well, I guess what I'm really wondering is, are you self-conscious about your looks, or were you ever? Like, did your looks ever really matter to you one way or another?
I do not think about. I think of myself as one big prop, and I'll do anything for a laugh. And I think, like, I like the idea when I have to get dressed up and go someplace. It's very special to me, and I like to do my own hair and makeup, and I like clothes that I own. I don't like to be dressed for anything, and that way I feel like I'm dressing up. But I don't really break it down and think of myself, oh, am I pretty or unattractive? I know I'm not completely ugly where people shy away, you know, like the Elephant Man, you know. I know I'm not like that, but I just don't think about it.
Do you usually think of yourself as one big prop, like when you're not on stage? How do you dress and how do you look?
Seems like I'm always in something homemade or an apron, I'm barefoot at home. I dress for comfort, elastic waistbands. it's true, you know, and I'm just very comfortable. I remember growing up, I had a neighbor who was she was so unattractive. I would go to her house and her hair would be just a mess, like a monkey, you know, and you could kind of see her scalp through her head and through her hair. And she was always in the basement and it was dark and she was sewing. And then when she had to dress up and go out, she was gorgeous. And I remember thinking, God, your mom is like so beautiful. She would put on wigs and lots of makeup and beaded gowns, and she was nothing like the woman during the day. And I think that really affected me. You know, I remember thinking, "Wow, what a transformation!" And I like that. I don't get recognized that much on the street. You know, I like playing, you know, being in disguise.
Now I want to get back to the voice that you do as Jerry, and you've said that you can only do line readings when you're in a role in her voice. Would you do her voice a little bit for us so we can hear it back to back with your voice?
Sure. She kind of sounds like this. Hey, Terry, how's it going? Yeah, it's pretty hot out here today. That's kind of how she talks.
Yeah, well, it's more nasal, and it also sounds older than your voice does.
I always play older for some strange reason. And then David said to me one day, he goes, "What are you going to do when you're like 56? And I go, "That's when I'll play teenagers." You know? I don't know. I've always liked playing older. When I was younger, I used to pretend that I would dress up like my mother, and I would try to fool my friends, like David's friends, when they would come over, and I would pretend I was mom, and they would fall for it. I was just thinking about that the other day. Like, but I must have been pretty good for them to fall for it, you know, because I'm a big collector of wigs and I props and, oh gosh, wardrobe. I mean, I save everything, and I dressed up just like my mom, and I truly convinced several people who came to my house that I was the mother. I don't know. I like playing older.
How old were you when you started getting into props and disguises?
Gosh, I have no idea. It must have been, gosh, I know in third grade I got my first fall, which I still have. And then I get a wig every Christmas still. My first wig was in third grade. I'd say I was, you know, first, second grade, you know, making faces and playing around. And I have stuff from when I was a lot younger.
My guest is Amy Sedaris. She co-wrote and stars in the new movie Strangers with Candy. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Amy Sedaris, and she stars in and co-wrote the new movie Strangers with Candy, which is a prequel to the Comedy Central TV series of the same name. You know, one of the things I find really interesting about you and your brother David Sedaris is that you're like flip sides of the same coin in the way. You know, in his essays, in his personal essays, he often writes about just the kind of thing that most people would try to keep secret because they'd find it embarrassing to reveal. Certain obsessions, habits, embarrassing situations, you know, physical problems, stuff like that. And that's exactly what he'll focus on to reveal to everybody in his writing. And you've always been into disguising, into kind of having some kind of disguise that separates you from the self that's, you know, that kind of keeps your own self hidden and puts a mm-hmm. kind of other self between you and the rest of the world. I don't know what my question is exactly, but you seem kind of opposite in that sense.
Well, it's interesting you should say that because I was thinking of that last week, too, because I was thinking someone was asking me a question about drama. You know, I love watching anything serious. You know, I love drama. I love people who can cry on the spot. I love real actors. And I don't want to do those roles because I kind of feel like that's who I am in my real life. Like if I'm in a relationship or whatever, I'm from at home with you talking, then I'm going to be who I am. You know, I am who I am. I'm a pretty real person. And so to me, to do that in front of a camera, I kind of like, why would I expose myself like that? That's who I am. That's not fun. I don't feel like I'm playing. I want to feel like I'm pretending. And if that's me, then I don't really feel like it's just not as fun. And plus, then what am I in real life? What am I when I'm, let's say I'm with a boyfriend, I'm crying my eyes out, then that's real. If I can do it on the spot in front of a camera, that's strange to me. You know, I'm trying to figure out how to articulate it because someone thinks it's fear and I'm just, you know, afraid to do it. And I'm like, no, I just don't want to. You know, I like feeling like I'm playing. And if I have to memorize lines and have a true moment and all that stuff, so it's like, oh, okay, but aren't there other people out there who can do it better and who want to do this? I just don't see the fun in it. But that's why I like to see that stuff or read those kinds of books. You know, I like the real stuff.
You know, I was mentioning how your brother David Sedaris will write things that are, like, so personal, exactly the kind of things that other people might not want to talk about. I remember once he gave a talk at an author's breakfast, and he'd been flying around a lot on tour, and one of the things he talked about was a boil on his behind.
Yeah.
And everybody's eating breakfast.
Boy, y'all heard about that boil.
Right, everybody's eating breakfast, and that's what he's talking about. But it was hysterically funny. It was just absolutely hysterically funny. But that was so typical of him. Would that be very counter to your personality?
Well, no, I would totally do something. I think everyone in my family is like that. You know, you just kind of put it out there. It's like, well, there's nothing to be embarrassed about. Or, you know, a lot of people think, oh, you're doing it for shock value. Or, and you're like, no, you're just doing it because you can or you want to. Or it's just the way your take on something. That's the first thing you think of. You know, I remember David helping me in when I was in high school and I had to memorize, like, the Julius Caesar speech, you know, friends, Roman countrymen. And he had me do it in a completely different, you know, way than standing up and just saying it. He had me do it in like this talk show format for the class. You know what I mean? He would always help me with any kind of project, but he would make me see it in a different way. Or why don't you do it this way? You know, don't do it the way they expect you to do it. Try it this way. And it would be a lot more fun.
How did you do Friends, Romans, and Countrymen as a talk show guest?
I kept breaking up the conversation, like, tell me where you are, you know, who are you speaking to right now? Friends, Romans. I just kept interacting like I was being interviewed, but it was just me doing it. You know what I mean? So I would just keep changing seats and going back and forth. And I would break up the speech by asking the question that would be in the speech, you know.
What did your acting teacher think?
Oh, well, it wasn't for acting. It was for English.
It was for English.
But
right?
So I took acting in school, and he was always improvise, or we would audition for plays that we would never put on because the school didn't have the money. So at some point, it was like I had to stop taking drama because he was like, there's nothing else to do here. You know, you've done it. But I won, like, drama awards. And so I was kind of like that person in school. And I was still in Girl Scouts, you know. And I was a Girl Scout until my senior year of high school. I loved Girl Scouts.
What did you like about it? It's so not your character.
But that's just it. Well, it is who I am. I love crafts. I like getting together with a group of people and just doing things. I mean, all we did was, like, play games and sell cookies, and there weren't that many of us. You know, go on field trips, go camping. I did a lot of that when I was younger. I was in a lot of clubs. I was in junior achievements. I was always trying to sell something, and I still do that today with my cupcake and cheese ball business. I have to make a dollar. You know, I have to see it, and I have to see it in a jar, and just I have to have several jars in my apartment, and I love everything about selling a product.
When you were in the Girl Scouts, did you like having a uniform?
I love uniforms. I collect uniforms.
You do?
Yes, I do. I have a lot of uniforms. I love them. David always said, he goes, I always remember Amy being in uniforms, you know, coming and going, always in a uniform. Yeah, I have my Winn-Dixie uniform, my Red Lobster uniform. I have a beautiful nursing uniform. I have a UPS uniform, police uniform, hospital gear. I have a lot of, there's a uniform in, it's like a baton twirling uniform that Tammy Little Nut wears in the movie Strangers with Candy. She wears my green little outfit. I drag all my props to every photo shoot, you know, I'm like, here you go, here are all my props, my glasses, my, you know, uniforms. What are we going to do? Huh. I'm like a little traveling one-man band.
How do you feel when you're the subject of your brother David Sedaris' fiction? Or, you know, a personal essay, I should say. And he's writing about you and maybe, you know, revealing something that you wouldn't necessarily want revealed, or maybe you would, I don't know. Does he ask you first?
if you see that son of a bitch, no, David doesn't have to ask me, you know, because I know David's not going to write something. David knows what he can write about and what he can't write about, so it's usually okay, you know. He'll send me stories, you know, and the fatty suit story I didn't see till it came out in print, but he's never embarrassed me. One time he said something on the radio about, I rock in bed on my side at a rapid motion. That's where I get a lot of my thinking done. And he mentioned that once on the air, and I remember thinking, oh, wow, that's odd that he would mention that. Like, I've never told anybody that before, and it's just because I never thought about mentioning it. So that kind of just threw me off guard for a little bit, but it was fine. You know, I'm not embarrassed by it. It's just that he would say it. I didn't think it was coming, you know. But I have to rock, that way I can think about stuff. You know, some people go for runs or get on the, you know, treadmill and walk or, mm-hmm. you know, I just have to be moving and rocking. And that's why I could never have hair extensions. And that's why I have a huge nest in the back of my head. It's from rocking. All my hair's all knitted up. It's pretty funny.
Now, you have a book that's coming out in the fall.
Yes, I do.
That's called I Like You, Hospitality Under the Influence.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about what you're doing in the book.
Well, it's I've always been, I like to cook. My mom, everyone in my family's, we cook for ourselves. And I've always wanted to put together a cookbook. So this book is all my favorite, you know, all my jackpot recipes. And then I have a craft section because I like crafting. Or I like coming up with the idea and having other people craft. I'm really good with ideas. I just can't always execute it. I don't have the skills. And then I just have different chapters on I put myself in different situations to entertain, like if someone's grieving, what to do. Like when my mom died, that was a challenge. You're having people come to your house. What do you do? You're certainly not up for it. A challenge about, you know, feeding a lumberjack, you know, hot lunches or having a children's party. And so I took the book seriously. You know, I thought I'm going to do a serious book on, you know, hospitality because, you know, I grew up in the South and there were these hospitality shows that I was obsessed with. And I think, you know, I just love everything about it. So Paul Dinello was reading it and yawning completely throughout the whole thing. And then he said the humor in the book came from Paul making fun of me. You know what I mean? Him commenting on me taking it so seriously. So now the book is a little bit more entertaining than what I wanted. But it's just me. I shot everything in my apartment. I hired a small team to make the crafts. I made all the food, and it's been a total learning experience because I'm not a writer. I can write on my feet, but I'm not a disciplined writer, and so it was really hard.
Do you give a lot of parties?
I'm a last-minute entertainer. You know, I'll say, hey, why don't you come over tomorrow night and we'll do so-and-so, and then it kind of develops. And then I always sell stuff at my parties. Like, I'll put, like, last night I had people over, and then I, like, stuff I want to get rid of that I feel too guilty putting in the hallway, I set up my sale table, and I have, like, almost empty bottles of lotion, dish detergent, soap, sponges, if I have pharmaceutical goods, whatever I have, and everything's for 25 cents. And I only take quarters, not two dimes and a nickels or three nickels and a dime. And I set up my little table and I take it very seriously. I just like the transaction. And then I sell what I can.
That's crazy.
But it's not crazy, Terry, because I bet there's a lot of stuff in your house. Next time you have people come over and you think, oh, you know what? I'm done with that book. I don't want to keep it. Someone will buy it for 25 cents. And larger sale items I put in my hallway, like buckets and fans, you know, but people are really happy to get it. And it's a quarter, you know, of the DVD of Valley of the Dolls I sold last night for 25 cents.
Now, these are your friends. How come you're not giving them away? How come it's not like a freebie table?
No, nothing's for free. I like 25 because then I can use that quarter to do my laundry. And I just like them have the transaction. They have to pay for it. And I'm not going to break a dollar. It's like, go get a quarter. I'm very picky about it. I like how people will look at the table and they look at stuff. They pick it up. They put it down. It's really fun.
Amy Sedaris, thank you so much for talking with us.
It was so nice talking to you.
Amy Sedaris co-wrote and stars in the new movie Strangers with Candy. It opens June 28th in New York and in other cities in July. Her book, I Like You, Hospitality Under the Influence, will be published in the fall. Coming up, John Powers recommends a new spy novel by Alan First. This is Fresh Air. Alan First has a new historical spy novel called Foreign Correspondent. His first one, Night Soldiers, came out in 1988, and he's written 8 more since then. His popularity is on the rise, and his last few books, including Blood of Victory and Dark Voyage, have been on the bestseller list. Critic at large John Powers, who says he always snaps up a new one, explains his appeal.
A few years ago, I asked the filmmaker David Lynch which movies he found exciting. The first title he came up with was Hitchcock's Rear Window. "It's got that mood," he said. "You know, I like a mood I can sink into." I thought about this recently as I sank into The Foreign Correspondent, the latest book by Alan First, who over the last few years has become our most acclaimed spy novelist. First doesn't give us the cartoon plots of Ian Fleming or Robert Ludlum, nor does he try to milk today's headlines with tales of international terror. Instead, he specializes in a highly literate escapism that taps into our continuing fascination with World War II. The Foreign Correspondent is quintessential First. Beginning in 1938, it tells the story of Carlo Weiss, an Italian reporter based in Paris who sometimes writes pieces for a newspaper published by Italy's anti-fascist opposition, known as the Gilisti. After one of the group's leaders is murdered by Mussolini's secret police, Weiss gets sucked deeper into the resistance, eventually becoming a pawn in a 3-dimensional chess game played by British intelligence, the French Sûreté, and the totalitarian thugs in Roman Berlin. In this precarious world of spy and counter-spy, merely ghostwriting an anti-fascist memoir can prove as deadly as the overt espionage that Weiss's lover Clara is doing in Germany. First takes pride in writing spy novels that are different. The heroes aren't the predictable Yanks or Brits, but usually men without a country, Russian emigre poets, Dutch sea captains, anti-fascist Bulgarians who wind up working for Stalin's secret police. And their lives don't affect World War II's main events. They're part of lesser-known sideshows, the fight to stop Germany's supply of Romanian oil, for instance, or the anti-Mussolini underground. First researches his books carefully, and reading them, you always discover something new and interesting. In fact, The Foreign Correspondent inspired me to order a book about Italian fascism. Oddly, for all his skill, First's not especially good at the things you might expect a spy novelist to excel at. He betrays no great interest in taut plotting. His stories drift along. And from book to book, his heroes are so unmemorable you recall them primarily by their nationalities. No matter. The reason I read First, and I've devoured all 9 of his World War II novels, is that he shares Lynch's grasp of mood. He's superb at sucking you into the mental atmosphere of 30s Europe, when tens of millions of people felt the evil gathering and lived with the dread of what torrents it might bring. First has no peer at capturing the crazy, sinister, yet strangely seductive textures of the run-up to war, especially in Paris, the center of his fictional universe. He imbues the City of Lights with a dusky, menacing glamour, adorning its boulevards with conspirators and counter-conspirators, unsettling headlines and jittery conversations, brasserie shootouts, and teasing erotic encounters. Where bad artists are suckers for World War II's crudest iconography, think how V for Vendetta used gaudy banners and jackboots to portray a futuristic England, First knows that what makes this period alluring isn't really its murderer's row of dictators, Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini. It's the way that ordinary people lived in the shadows cast by these oversized tyrants. First's heroes are smart, essentially decent men who'd rather be going on with their lives, but find themselves inescapably caught up in the wheels of history. And given the direction those wheels are moving, they just as inescapably realize that they must do something to resist. Like the supposedly cynical Rick in Casablanca, or the resistant fighters of Jean-Pierre Melville's Army of Shadows, by miles the best movie in our theaters right now. Characters like Carlo Weiss risk their lives doing dangerous things that may look minor, might well be forgotten, but maybe, just maybe, will prove absolutely necessary. Such uninflected courage is especially appealing in an era like our own, when so many of us feel that today's most unsettling forces, from international terror to climate change, are too big and too complicated for even 007 to solve. And this, I suspect, is one reason why First's novels have recently become so popular. Reassuringly set in an aestheticized past, we know how World War II came out, after all, First captures the feeling of another time, when things seemed out of control. And by giving us life-size heroes, not Superman, he lets us imagine that we too could be capable of doing our own brave part to slow down the runaway train of history.
John Powers is Fresh Air's critic at large and film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Art of War by Sun Tzu, in stores and online at bn.com. From Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. Information at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. And from Picture House, presenting the Robert Altman film A Prairie Home Companion, with a cast that includes Kevin Klein, Virginia Madsen, and Meryl Streep, now in theaters. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, civil liberties lawyer Joseph Margulies talks about representing detainees in Guantanamo. He took their case to the Supreme Court, arguing they had a right to the legal process. The court ruled in his favor. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.